Hello, and welcome back to the Joint Venture Podcast, Inspiration Your Insights. Today, I am pleased to say that I am joined once again by our senior reporter, Zachary Skidmore, our senior analyst, Chenpo Chintu.
Hey, Oliver.
And joining us for the first time for his debut on the podcast, Oren Serafin.
Hey, Oliver.
So, on this episode, we're going to go over the latest news and analysis from the last week of Inspiration's coverage, including a look at the pros and cons of financing merchant versus PPA operations. Chan was going to be talking us through that later, and some of the problems that projects can get into later in their operation with failure rates of wind turbines. Oren here is also going to take us through some of the data he's been analysing for us, and with a particular focus on the Saudi Arabia region. Stay tuned for that. But we're going to begin this episode, as usual, with a news update. Zach, what have you found this week?
So, a number of stories came to my attention this week. The first being the launch of a fourth renewables fund by the world's largest asset manager, BlackRock. They launched their fourth global renewable power fund with a target size of $7 billion. The fund, which is based in New York, will be focused on developing projects in OECD countries, investing in sectors across wind, solar, battery storage, and grid infrastructure. It's aiming for a target size between $5 billion and $7 billion.
How does this compare to BlackRock's previous funds?
So the fund's predecessor, Global Renewable Power Fund 3, actually reached its final close in April 2021 with total fundraise of $4.8 billion. It's made several high-profile investments, including an investment in Ionity's high-power EV charging network, which raised $700 million. And in March 2023, it also invested $700 million in the Waratah Super Battery in Australia, which when complete will be the world's biggest grid-scale battery project. The second story of note came from Swedish wind developer Vattenfall, who inaugurated its largest onshore wind farm in the UK. The 240-megawatt South Kyle onshore wind farm was developed and constructed entirely by Vattenfall. Following the inauguration, Greencoat UK Wind will assume ownership of the installation, with Vattenfall managing the asset on behalf of Greencoat for at least 10 years once operational. So the inauguration is part of a growing portfolio of offshore wind. Vattenfall currently has an offshore wind pipeline of 5.5 gigawatts across all its markets, of which 500 megawatts are in the UK. The project is also tied to a 10-year power purchasing agreement with AJ Barr, a soft drink manufacturer, I believe the manufacturer of Iron Brew. So the agreement's going to provide 22 gigawatt hours of renewable capacity per year, which will be fed into the Cumberland and Milton Keynes factories, as well as regional sites across Bolton, Forfair, Newcastle, Sheffield, the West Midlands and Manchester. The next story of note came from DIF Capital Partners, who reached financial close on a co-located solar generation and battery storage portfolio in the UK. The financing structure covers the first 540 megawatts of projects in the portfolio and comprises of fully committed senior debt facilities. This is provided by senior lenders such as ABN, ING, Rabobank and Lloyds, with Lloyds acting as the senior agents. The portfolio consists of seven ready-to-build sites with 380 megawatts of solar capacity and 340 megawatts of battery energy storage, giving a combined capacity of 720 megawatts. And since the acquisition, DIF has noted that the first two projects have commenced construction, and they expect all projects to be operational between 2024 and 2025. The purchase of the portfolio was made through the DIF Infrastructure 7 Fund, a pure equity fund which invests in both greenfield and operational companies, platforms and assets around Europe, the Americas and Australasia. Moving on, this is actually a bit of an exclusive, I think, garnered by our journalist Ash, who spoke to Macquarie Asset Management, who revealed details about its newly commissioned battery energy storage system. This was done in conjunction with EQ Energy, who, with project partners NG Influence, commissioned the new Hazelwood battery energy storage project in Australia. The project has a capacity of 150 megawatts of solar, as well as 150 megawatt hour battery energy storage unit, and it was jointly funded and developed by EQ and NG, with NG being the majority owner at 70% and EQ owning 30% of the site. The project, which is Australia's largest privately funded utility-scale battery is located on the former site of Hazelwood Power Station in the Latrobe Valley in Victoria, making the project what is thought to be Australia's first retired coal-fired power station to host a utility-scale battery.
I think we have one more story before we wrap up, Zach.
This is quite a big story, actually. Reports have come that BP and Ørsted have come to an agreement over a North Sea offshore wind project, ending a two-year-long dispute. The oil major has wrote a letter to the UK's Department for Energy Security and Net Zero, confirming that it has reached a commercial agreement with Ørsted over its 2.6 gigawatt Hornsea 4 wind farm. BP noted that it no longer requires protective provisions and has no further objections to Hornsea 4's development consent order. The letter stated that BP will withdraw any and all prior representations made in relation to Ørsted's plans. The actual dispute arose over the location of the project, which BP argued would render its carbon capture storage project unviable. BP argued that the wind farm would hamper its ability to monitor its upcoming Endurance Reservoir, which will receive emissions from the Northern Endurance Partnership CCS initiative.
Yeah, this is an interesting one. It'll be good to see if we can find some more detail on exactly what these two massive energy companies have agreed between them. Although this is not by no means the only problem that Ørsted's Hornsea 4 plant was running into.
Definitely. So lastly, I just want to bring attention to a couple of Q&As that we have published, which I think will be very interesting to read through for any listeners to the podcast. The first being a Q&A with AFC Energy, who are a hydrogen company and have developed a novel cracker technology.
This is really interesting. So ammonia cracking is one of these technologies we're going to have to get a lot better at if we are going to use ammonia as an interim for moving hydrogen by sea around the world. The idea is that you can store a lot more hydrogen per unit volume into an ammonia solution by creating that at one port and then cracking or removing the nitrogen from the solution, making hydrogen at the destination port.
Yeah, so AFC are kind of at the forefront of that, and they've pinpointed a number of markets where they're going to invest heavily in, with Europe being a primary focus due to the European market's desire to wean away from Russian gas. So it will be very interesting to see the development of the company and if their cracker technology really gets going. The second Q&A was done with 3i Infrastructure, and we spoke to Scott Mosley, who is the managing partner and co-head of European Infrastructure. During the Q&A, we had a good overview of the fund itself, focusing specifically on the future of the data center market, the role of essential services in upscaling of offshore wind, and what sectors to look out for in the near to mid future.
Thank you very much, Zach, for the news update and for keeping those Q&As coming. Those are fascinating content on the website, which I would encourage our listeners to go and find. There's one every Monday. So it's now time to move on to looking at some of the analysis that Inspiration has put out over the last week, starting with a piece which our very own Chandwa here wrote about how developers are dealing with an increase in merchant risk and the pros and cons of merchant operations as opposed to PPAs. Now, this was a fascinating article, Chandwa. Can you take us through some of the outlines that we might need to understand what's coming later?
Yeah, for sure, 100%. I think to begin, to give some context, we have to go all the way back to our European PPA Outlook report, which highlighted an increase in projects undertaking merchant operations. I think there was a lot of talk about merchant operations last year with the uncertainty and volatility of electricity prices. And going on from that, one is left to wonder, why would a developer opt out of the certainty and security of a power purchase agreement and dive into merchant operations with using an asset whose output itself is intermittent? Well, it turns out there are several considerations, several factors that one needs to think about when deciding whether to contract their energy or take on full merchant operations or hybridize their revenue streams.
So the basic argument that we've been familiar with for some time is that a PPA will give you a guaranteed price return based on the output you produce, because every megawatt is priced then the same to your buyer. But merchant, or just selling onto the open market, comes with all the volatility of that. And if you're running renewables projects where the market price would presumably fall when other renewables are also going to be high, there comes an increased risk of increased volume risk and price risk of not being able to ship your energy at peak times.
Exactly that. And on top of that, the PPA or agreements within the PPAs shift a lot of the risk from the generator to the offtaker. So even in times of curtailment, the risk of revenue loss is shifted to the offtaker rather than the generator. And so what that means from a debt financing perspective is that it's much easier for a developer to seek out or raise debt with a project that has a PPA compared to a project that is fully merchant. And it's particularly interesting if you look at it from the perspective of an equity investor. That's a perspective I took in my recent article. So what we did is we modeled a simple onshore wind farm in the UK. So what we did was we modeled a simple onshore wind farm in the UK and looked at equity returns for the project if it were under a PPA or if it was under full merchant operations.
So these are all models that we have developed as Inspiratia in-house. This isn't based on external sources.
No, this is our own data that we've built as a team. And it is quite interesting to see the numbers that we have produced reflected well with what we are hearing in the market.
I was bringing that up to say this isn't some model that we have been handed by an equity investor trying to make a particular point. This is an independent analysis.
No, it's independent analysis and it fully represents an Inspiratia insight. Yeah, so what it shows really is the perceived risks of merged operations versus contracting of power through a PPA. If you look into the article, we made a representative graph of the internal rate of return that an equity investor would expect to see with this project. And what's particularly interesting is that because, at the moment at least, spot prices or futures are significantly higher than an agreed upon PPA, the IRR rises much more sharply for merchant projects compared to PPAs. And that's simply because of the higher prices. But at the same time, you have to consider that these spot prices or future prices are simply a best guess by a forecasting company. And on top of that, a developer is much more prudent with their modeling. So if you're modeling a project for merchant operations, you're using P90 or P99 wind forecast values as opposed to P50 with a PPA.
So just to translate, that means you're sort of taking the worst case scenario in terms of the wind output generation?
Not necessarily the worst case scenario. You're being more conservative of the wind resource and the generation you could potentially make in the project. And you're doing that because you're unsure of the future, even though you have a best guess of what the power prices will be. But even with that, the returns that could be had are much greater than if you contracted your power through a PPA. But that doesn't mean that everyone should go merchant.
So can you talk us through some of the key differences between the two routes to market then?
It also goes down to the policy environment one is operating in. If you look at Europe right now, the European Union recently published the reform on the electricity market. And that brought about certain changes to PPA contracts and the stability that off-takers can have with credit backings from government, so thereby eliminating certain risks of default from certain off-takers, and also two-way CFDs from auctions. So that makes PPAs a bit more attractive compared to merchant operations. But still, on top of that, there's several other factors that one needs to consider. For instance, if you're looking at PPAs, a lot of people want to contract all their power for the security and longevity of offtake. So the investor pool for projects with PPAs is much larger than the investor pool for merchant projects alone. The payback period for a merchant project is much less, obviously due to the higher returns. And the equity capital risk, so the capital that's injected by equity investors into a project, is at risk at a much higher rate in merchant projects than with PPA projects, just due to the fact that you're unsure about the revenues you make, even though you've used very conservative modeling techniques and have the best guess of what power prices will be in the future.
What does this analysis show going forward? What lessons can we take from this for looking at different options for financing these projects?
I think what I was trying to bring out here is that there are several options these days. I think in the early days of renewables, at least in Europe, it was very easy, PPA or nothing, really. But these days, at least that we will see further on in our upcoming PPA report, our mid-year PPA report, is that there's a lot of hybridization of revenue schemes, PPA, merchant, CFD. And so there's several options for developers and financiers out there. And it's all about competition. If you look at the UK, there's a limited amount of PPA projects because a lot of developers are competing for CFDs. And the attractiveness of merchant operations in the UK is quite good because of the high prices. But even then, the security of PPAs is still attractive. So despite the frequency of high prices on day-ahead markets increasing or still at a very high level, merchant projects are definitely on the rise and more popular. But PPAs and CFD projects or government-backed schemes still offer security that certain developers like. And at the end of the day, it depends on the risk profile of said developer.
So as part of this research, you modeled an onshore wind farm and modeled the return year on year well into the project's future. But obviously, one of the things that models also need to take into account, as well as, of course, the inherent risk of the financing side, there are material risks that come up in operation and maintenance of wind farms in particular.
Yeah, for sure. These are things that generally can be modeled very easily. But when there is a shock in the system, it can affect the returns of a project. And we reviewed, I think 2 weeks ago, we looked at how wind turbines generally are getting much larger, chasing higher capacity factors, chasing efficiency, which is generally a good thing overall. But from an engineering standpoint, these larger turbines are a bit more unstable than their smaller predecessors. And what we're seeing is an increase in the failure rates of turbines. There's several notable examples in recent months about offshore wind turbines and onshore wind turbines failing mechanically, failing structurally, and those turbines are on the larger side. And so one thing that is now becoming a bigger part of the conversation is operations and maintenance of these turbines themselves. And so a question that developers may be asking today is that chase for a larger turbine justified, even though we might need to spend a bit extra on operations and maintenance?
Well, the race is always on to make the next big turbine that these huge offshore projects in particular are going to use. So assuming that turbines do get bigger, what are the pitfalls that developers need to look out for in the design stage?
I'm sure manufacturers like Vestas and Nordex alike are keenly aware of this. And it's an awareness of the system frequencies from an engineering standpoint, the system frequencies of the structure and how the vibrations of the turbine affects the vibrations of the supporting structure, and whether or not the frequency of those vibrations overlap and can cause damage. It's just crucial to understand the loading requirements of wind turbine at the sites in which they will be deployed.
So it's harmonic resonance. This is
it's literally harmonic resonance, yeah.
It's for the same reason that the opera singer can supposedly break a wine glass if they sing the right note. And we're actually recording this just a few minutes' walk from Millennium Bridge, or as it was known when it first opened, the Wobbly Bridge, that had this very problem with the resonance of people using it, walking on it. Walking pace was the resonance of that bridge, and it started to fail.
100%. And it's very possible to mitigate the risks associated with resonance expectations in wind turbine design and management. And I'm sure this is what's being done anyways. But it's very interesting to see that there is a higher failure rate of larger wind turbines. And I'm sure the market is aware of this and will look into this. But for now, it's an interesting trend that is happening.
Well, I think the lessons are certainly being learnt by current projects. But it's interesting how the same kind of engineering problems can come up in very different fields. Fantastic. Thank you so much, Chandwa.
Thank you, Oliver.
Moving on, we now have a segment where we're going to look at the data of Inspiratio's project database, DataLive, and our very own Oren Serafin has been looking into the energy profile of Saudi Arabia. Welcome, Oren.
Thanks, Oliver, for having me on.
So tell us, why did you want to write about Saudi Arabia for this data byte?
Yeah, so I came on the team here at Inspiratio in the middle of May, and in my job going through the different data entries that I would upload to the system, I began to notice more and more frequently that there were a lot of data entries for the Saudi Arabia region, which coming in was definitely not an expectation that I had. So that really piqued my interest in the subject, and so I wanted to dive a little bit deeper into the area.
So why is Saudi Arabia of interest to us from a renewable point of view, from a sustainable infrastructure point of view then?
Yeah, so Saudi Arabia, when you think of it, you really don't think of renewable energy whatsoever. You think of a massive oil producer one of the leaders within the OPEC coalition. You really don't think of renewable energy whatsoever. They're literally second in the world only to the United States for their role in producing oil. And so the fact that they came up so frequently within the renewable energy sphere was really interesting to me, because they actually announced recently that they had a goal that by 2030, they wanted their domestic consumption of energy to be 50% natural gas and 50% from renewable sources. And I found that to be really interesting because, just as one might suspect, their current consumption was 60.8% oil, 39.01% natural gas, and 0.07% solar. And so they're a long ways off from that goal. But they have made significant strides, as I found in my time here, towards addressing that goal somewhat.
Of course, Saudi Arabia is famous for the oil, but equally the deserts, the hot sun, we'd think it would be the ideal place for doing solar developments. So is that something that you found in your research?
Yeah, so as you might expect, solar makes up 40% of the renewable and transmission investments that Saudi Arabia has undertaken within the last few years as part of their plan to reach the 50-50 split goal that they have by 2030. Saudi Arabia is within the desert, and so they try and make use of the resources that they have there. And for example, the second most common project that they have under their belt would be water treatment, which is another thing you might expect for a desert nation trying to rely more heavily on renewable energy and gain their energy from renewable sources. And so solar energy makes up 40%. And then when you combine solar and water treatment, that makes up 60% of their investment.
When you look at solar, particularly in Saudi, it's very interesting. They have this very popular company called Aqua Power, and they're quite prominent in the Middle East region. And I just mentioned them because I've remembered now that for one of their solar plants, they managed to get a feed-in tariff from the Saudi government, which at the time was the lowest in the world. I don't think anyone's gone lower. It was cents per kilowatt.
Yeah, no, and I've definitely come across Aqua Power while doing the work that I've been doing, as well as some of the PPA entries that I've been doing with you as well, Chandwa. And yeah, I mean, solar really does make up a significant portion of the portfolio of the 17 gigawatts of capacity that Saudi Arabia has developed since announcing their plan to go after the goal. 12 gigawatts of those have been solar alone. And when it comes to the numbers itself, by transaction value, solar makes up the largest type of investment with $18.3 billion. But interestingly enough, the second most common type of investment that Saudi Arabia has undertaken isn't a traditional renewable energy source. It's actually transmission lines for gas.
Natural gas pipelines.
Yes. So they've made a $15.5 billion investment in natural gas pipelines, which you might not expect, as they're going after a 50-50 split for their renewable energy goal. That is, until you think about what their goal is specifically, and it's a 50-50 split between natural gas and renewable sources. And so they've made significant investments, not only into the renewable energy, but to address all parts of their plan as well, as they're using natural gas as sort of a stepping stone to springboard themselves more into heavily renewable-based domestic consumption. And so I guess just one other point that I'd make while looking at sort of the transactional values of their investments is that the third largest source after solar and transmission was hydrogen, with an $8.4 billion investment, which that one was a little bit more surprising to me, because I understand that they would invest heavily in projects that relate to solar and then water treatment as well. Those make sense because Saudi Arabia is a desert nation, and those are pretty much what you'd expect a desert nation to do when focusing on renewable energy projects. But the hydrogen investment isn't necessarily the next thing you jump to. And so I feel like that sort of ties into my next point, which is the NEOM Green Hydrogen Project.
Yeah, I think what's particularly interesting about hydrogen and solar and Saudi Arabia is sort of linking electrolyzers to solar plants, which generally have a lower capacity factor, means that the maintenance you're paying for degradation of electrolyzer components is much less, because you're utilizing that electrolyzer a lot less. So It may be that solar and electrolyzers are a good combination, but hydrogen is definitely Oliver's forte. And he definitely has these thoughts about the NEOM investment.
I do have thoughts. Okay, so from a certain point of view, particularly if we look at the stated plan that we've just discussed, it makes sense that Saudi Arabia is thinking about hydrogen in the long term. As we've mentioned, it's made huge investments in its gas infrastructure. And although I haven't got confirmation of this, I'm pretty sure that a lot of that gas infrastructure will be made to a standard which would be compatible with hydrogen. So it's quite possible that this is being seen as a way of transitioning away from gas in the long term. So these are like very early stages of what will be a much larger industry later. However, one of the things that Saudi Arabia really needs to deal with if it is going to reach these targets, the solar capacity alone will not be enough, partly because the energy storage required for that is absolutely huge, and the peaks of solar generation during the day need to be transferred to periods of high usage during the evening and night. So one of the primary reasons I think Saudi is looking at hydrogen so fervently at the moment is it's a future fuel on the way to renewables, and in the short term to help alleviating the temporal issues of power generation and moving the high generation points to the high usage points.
Is there anything else you found interesting, Oren?
Yeah, no, and honestly, that's a really intriguing point, Oliver. And kind of to continue off of that, it makes a lot of sense for Saudi Arabia, too, to look at these different sources of energy because, like you said, solar itself isn't going to drive them to the capacity that they need to shift away from a primarily oil and natural gas-based consumption system. And even though they have made significant investments into solar and water treatment projects, they have 13 in solar and 6 in water treatment over the past 4 years. Every other project category that they've invested in, if they've invested in at all, is broken down by subsector, does not exceed one unique project per category. And so, for example, they're involved in transmission, hydrogen, education, hybrid telecoms, and data centers. But each of those projects only contains one deal itself. And so I feel as though if Saudi Arabia is going to be successful in the goal that they've stated, an important part in achieving that is diversifying their investments and building off of some of the investments that they've already made, because they do deserve applause for making those investments in the first place. But if they are sincere about what they want to do, they should continue to develop these projects. And so, yeah, Saudi Arabia has definitely made significant strides to reach the goal of a 50-50 split between natural gas and renewable energy sources for domestic consumption by 2030. But that isn't to say that there's still a lot of work to be done. These projects total to about 17 gigawatts of capacity, and their total generating capacity currently stands at around 82 gigawatts. By 2030, they have a goal of reaching 160 gigawatts, and so that leaves roughly 60 gigawatts of investments that still need to be made within the next 7 years. To look at one sort of alarming trend, the case count has actually dropped significantly, especially in the past 2 or 3 years as compared to 2020, because in 2020, they had 14 new case counts, 2021 was 8, 2022 was 7, and this year they're only at 4. And so,
so far this year.
Yes, that is true. It is only 4 so far this year, but that does put them on pace to end at around 8 or 7, as opposed to the 14 or 15 that they would most likely need to keep themselves on pace to expand their capacity enough to address the goals that they've imposed upon themselves. And so Saudi Arabia definitely does deserve some applause for the efforts that they made thus far. But I would say that there is a lot more work to be done and that they should step up their game, I guess, for lack of a better word, in regards to continuing their renewable and infrastructure investments.
Thank you so much for that data roundup, Oren. And that is it for another week. Thank you so much for listening to the Joint Venture Podcast. I would like to thank all of our contributors. Thank you for coming on, Oren.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chandra.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you so much, Zach.
My pleasure, Oliver.
This week, Inspiratia is launching our latest Market Research Report. It is the latest installment of the Green Hydrogen Index, this time with a market focus on one of the more interesting and mature hydrogen markets out there, Japan. The Japanese market is absolutely fascinating. It's been wonderful to look into. Japan's unique place in the hydrogen economy is that really a lot of these technologies that we've been talking about, as if they are novel in Europe, have been deployed in Japan for decades now, and that market really has come along a long way, even though there are still some drawbacks in building up the project pipeline required for the scale of ambition that the Japanese government clearly have towards hydrogen. So more details on that in the report, which is now available on the Inspiration website. And that is it for us. We will be back again with more news and analysis next week. Thank you, and goodbye.